We touched down on milk prices on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could join in. Class 3 milk set a record high price last month. That's the milk that goes into making hard cheeses and cream cheese, other spreadable cheese. What does that mean for dairy farmers? And what's driving up the minimum price they get for their milk set by the Federal Milk Marketing Order Program? Join in on Market Conditions, 800-642-1234. Kevin Bernhardt is an agribusiness professor at UW-Platteville. He's also a farmer management specialist with UW Extension and the Center for Dairy Profitability. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Very nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. And we also have Mark Stevenson with us, Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, leads the Center for Dairy Profitability. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Kate. Glad to be here.
Mark, let's start with you. Why has the minimum price set for Class 3 milk spiked, and what should we be paying attention to here?
Well, those minimum prices from federal milk marketing orders are driven directly off a formula that's based on the value of the products made from it. So, for example, cheese and butter are input prices to determine what those farm milk prices are going to be. And those prices have been high. So we've seen record high prices at the farm level.
So what does inflation then that we're seeing across our economy have to do with the spike in these milk prices?
Well, to some extent, the inflation that we see at retail are, you know, being reflected back to the dairy farmer to some extent, but they're not retail prices that are used in those formulas, they're wholesale prices. But the whole supply chain has had input costs all the way up through the products that they're producing that have been rising as we've seen inflation rise. And unfortunately, I think there's probably more inflation to come. We usually are talking about the consumer price index, but if you look at the producer price index, you'll see that increase in inflation in that index has risen even faster. So that probably hasn't all been transmitted yet to the consumer.
Interesting. Kevin, let's bring in you here. First of all, what is the Federal Milk Marketing Order and how does it set prices for classes of milk?
Well, that's a good question back to Mark, really. But the Federal Milk Marketing Orders have been around for a long time. They've gone through several different iterations of changes in order reform. And we have the Farm Bill coming up here in another year. And there's already discussions for potential changes in the orders coming up this next year. But the orders are, again, Mark, you can speak to this better than I can, but there's several across the country. They are a way to set a regional milk price in a climate where at the beginning, at least, the nature of milk was hard to transport and so forth, and that's how they first got started. But they're the ones who are in charge of those formulas and gathering that information and ultimately coming up with what those minimum prices are.
It sounds like, Mark, that the Federal Milk Marketing Order lends some stability to milk prices, perhaps?
No, they really do, Kate. It's kind of like a deep rudder on a ship. You know, you're still going to get some movement out there, but it does provide stability. And I think it's also really important to remember that the federal order prices are minimum prices that plants that are regulated must pay. You're welcome to pay more. And in most cases they do. Those are over order premiums that are paid to dairy farmers. Those premiums have been shrinking. So even though this regulated minimum price has come up, the farm milk price, not quite by the same kind of percentage. So while it's still a good price time for farmers, it's maybe not as good as some folks may be imagining. Inflation is taking its toll, and we have had plants that have stepped out of regulation and have been paying what they can to get milk into the door of their plants.
Interesting. Mark Stevenson, Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Kevin Bernhardt here, agribusiness professor at UW-Platteville and a farmer management specialist at Extension, talking about the milk prices that we're seeing for dairy farmers, what they're getting for their milk, what this means for consumers, ultimately. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Questions about these prices, how they're set. Questions about what you're seeing about the price of cheese as you go shopping at the store. Back to you, Kevin. So you have said that farmers should use these high prices to prepare for a future time when prices drop. What type of advice are you giving to farmers now?
Take advantage, have some fun and take advantage. We have a history, with any kind of prices, commodity prices really, and class three milk prices are the same way. There's a history of hitting peaks but those peaks tend to beget the following low as well. Now, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that we have good prices here for a long time to come and we have a good profit margins for a long time to come. I hope that happens, but history would give us a different signal there that at some point things will happen. People will respond, producers will respond, consumers will respond, and those prices will drop. If you look back through our history, going back to the mid 90s, we've had several cycles since then, and it tended to take about 14 months on average. When once you hit the peak month, about 14 months later, give or take, 6 months around that, you would hit the low. So if that history repeats itself, this is a great time for producers to get the business in order, to make those investments in technologies that are going to put them in a good place if indeed that low price does come in the future. If it doesn't, you're still better off. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when you're saying have a little fun, investments in technology, would that be in that category of having fun, doing things that you would say help the business, ultimately the bottom line, but they're not entirely necessary?
No, I wouldn't say they were not entirely necessary.
Okay.
I think it's your commodity business, you're always wanting to look at cost reduction. How can we be more efficient in production? How can we be more efficient with our costs? Now you have the opportunity potentially to invest in those technologies that are going to help you with your feed waste. Maybe come up with a way to work with your feed refusals that you might have. Looking at cow comfort, looking at health protocols, there might be new facilities, there might be new technologies that often may be too costly. But now there's a chance to invest in those things.
Oh, I wonder, like a digester, perhaps?
Yeah, digester, robots fall into that. You know, lots of labor-saving technologies. It might be facilities that help better with cow flow.
Mm-hmm.
Any of those things that, every farm is going to be different, of course. But whatever it might be that can take you to the next generation of cost efficiency, that's only going to help. When those prices fall, you're not going to be hurt as bad if your costs have already fallen as well.
But Mark, look at cost inputs here in these times of inflation. Like, you've got the feed for the cows, you've got the electricity in the barns, you've got the fuel, the rising cost of gas. When you compare the input costs, is that tempering the spike you see in prices?
Well, I think it is. And, Kevin brings up a good point about the high prices begetting lower prices. But that's usually been because high prices and real profitability is a signal to dairy farmers that just says the market wants more milk, more of your product. And usually farms respond, and, collectively, our tens of thousands of farmers across the country produce a bit more milk than the market actually needed. And that's not happening yet, even though these prices are high. I think that, you know, because input prices are also high, farms are being more cautious this time around, or they're just not able to get some of those inputs that would help them really expand. Heifers is a good example. We haven't produced as many heifers for replacements as we have in the past. So I'm not sure we're going to get quite as much of a surge in milk production. In fact, currently, the last several months, we've been below your earlier levels. So that's kept our markets tight and supported these higher prices.
Talking about the record high price of Class 3 milk, the shifting market conditions for dairy farmers, we have UW Dairy Policy Analyst Mark Stevenson here, UW Platteville Agribusiness Professor Kevin Bernhardt, also a farmer management specialist at UW Extension. Dairy farmers, join in on what you're experiencing with the swing, how this affects the bottom line of your farm operation. Cheese lovers, join in on dairy prices at the grocery store, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the market for milk used to make cheese, the implications on dairy farmers getting record high prices for their milk. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. As we discuss market conditions, there is that backdrop that Wisconsin has led the nation in recent years in farm foreclosures. Join in on prices in the dairy industry, 800-642-1234. Agricultural economist Mark Stevenson focuses on dairy markets policy at UW-Madison, directs the Center for Dairy Profitability, stays with us, along with UW-Platteville agribusiness professor Kevin Bernhardt providing analysis. They're here for about 9 more minutes. Kevin, let's just acknowledge that in recent years, Wisconsin has led the nation in farm bankruptcies. What impact does a price swing like this have on, you know, debt obligations, on risk management, on a farm operation's overall bottom line?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when we have the high price time, most everybody is making money, right? So that is not where the problem is. The problem is going to be when and if those prices were to swing down, especially if the input prices stay sticky. And we end up in those negative profit margins. Some of the higher cost producers are going to struggle when that happens. If that continues for too long, that's when the bankruptcies or the decisions to get out of the business start to take place. And we end up having that exit from the industry. Now, that happened in those years, 2015 to 2018, in part because those low prices lasted for a long time over the course of those 4 years, and people just could not, some folks just could not keep up with that. Their current facilities just didn't support it. And so you will tend to have that exit from the industry whenever you have those poor profitability times.
Mark, jump in here, your thoughts.
Well, we've certainly seen loss of dairy farms. We saw quite a few farms that exited the business, not all of them for financial reasons per se. I mean, by that, I mean, they weren't necessarily driven out because of their dire circumstances, but because they were at a decision point. Our farmers are also becoming older, and we haven't replaced them quite as much. And, you know, if your farm is at a point where it needs to reinvest in those long-term assets, that farms have, then it's a decision point. Do we continue as an operating dairy farm, or do we sell our cows and maybe raise feed for a larger farm nearby that wanted our cows? So we've been seeing those kind of transformations happening across the countryside. We're still producing more milk than ever.
Major life decisions there. I want to talk about producing more milk, because just recalling back to the beginning of the pandemic and that oversupply of milk at the start of COVID causing farmers to dump like 25,000 gallons of milk daily. And we saw those images. So as you think back to that time, Mark, what does the supply chain for dairy products look like now compared to then?
Well, it's had some lasting impacts, but those impacts that you were talking about that caused that milk dumping were really quite short term in nature and relatively small volumes of milk. It may sound like a big number, but it's a small portion of total supply. The industry did a huge pivot kind of behind the scenes, that the plants that were producing dairy products, mostly for out of home eating, restaurant chains or schools or, you know, institutions, overnight went from full bore to zero. And everybody staying at home had to sneak out to the grocery store and buy their food and not eat out of the home. So it wasn't easy to get products made and into retail stores in the plants that were supplying them. But we did it. And, you know, it was a huge disruption to the industry, but the industry did it. So that was partly also because dairy farms voluntarily reduced milk production. Mm-hmm. They were asked to do so and they did it.
Kevin, what are those lessons learned from that massive supply chain pivot that you've talked about with farmers?
Well, there's a lot of lessons learned, but I think one of them that we can take away from that is the importance of risk management. So, you know, this was the pandemic was a black swan event. We certainly don't expect that to happen in a regular way. However, some kind of risk raises its ugly head every single year in some way or fashion. So that is something that dairy producers need to prepare for as well, whether it's a change in prices, whether it's something that happens in the supply chain that causes problems with being able to access their selling their milk, whatever it might be, there's always something out there that's going to be unexpected. And so they must prepare for that. And that involves making sure their debt level is in a good position, that they can access lending if they have to, that they have good working capital available in the business to meet those risks when they come, as well as being prepared with various insurance and price risk management tools and so forth.
Talking about the dairy industry, the milk prices with Kevin Bernhardt there, agribusiness professor at UW-Platteville. Mark Stevenson, director of dairy policy analysis at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Well, you know, I want to run this by you. As the dairy industry competes against these plant-based beverages, you know, this has been going on for decades. There's that tension around the, you know, right use of the term milk. What are the long-term implications that you see with milk alternatives on the industry? And Mark, you first.
Well, you know, the industry has been changing over a long period of time. You know, back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, when I was young, we drank a lot more milk. That was just a habit that people had. We had indication from the government that was good for us. And we've had no indications that it's been bad, but there's been a perception that plant-based foods may somehow be more friendly. And we've seen some consumers pivoting, but a lot of folks have just changed from a dairy-based diet to something else. However, what's happened mostly is that we've changed from drinking our dairy to eating our dairy. Cheese consumption is way up, yogurt consumption is up, butter consumption is up. So we're eating more solid dairy products and drinking less.
Interesting. Kevin, your thoughts there?
Well, you know, competition is not always bad, right? So as those different kinds of products are coming into the market and the dairy industry has to learn to compete against those, let the consumer know what the advantages are of dairy products, that may have some positive long-term impacts for the industry. And the other thing to think about too is, you know, if I'm a farm management specialist for the almond industry, then I think this is great to have almond milk, right? Farmers are of different kinds. We happen to be on the supporting the dairy farmer, and we would like to see them compete. I think that the dairy industry is going to be able to compete very well with the products that they have, that they're able to put together against the other alternatives that are out there.
Well, Mark and Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Mark Stevenson, Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, leads the Center for Dairy Profitability. Kevin Bernhardt is an agribusiness professor at UW-Platteville, farmer management specialist as well with UW Extension and the Center for Dairy Profitability. Ahead this hour, we talk with the director of Salud Mental about the program's efforts to eliminate mental health barriers in the Latinx community. Join in on culturally responsive mental health care, 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next, and Wisconsin Life here on the Ideas Network. You are with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our live coverage plans. Members of Congress are holding hearings in their investigation into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The House committee meets again Monday. Join us for live NPR coverage starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. The committee has spent a year investigating what happened when pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol, hoping to help overturn the 2020 election. Lawmakers are gathering evidence, hearing from witnesses. Join us for live NPR coverage Monday morning starting at 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about the lessons learned on a family camping trip.
Taking the kids camping usually sounds like a great idea, until it's not. Author BJ Hollers brings us a story about the trials and triumphs of the family camping trip.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. With those famous words, Charles Dickens opened his classic novel, which, if you read no further, might very well be a book about camping. Ah, camping. The foolhardiest of summer traditions. The chance to dust off the tent, unfurl the sleeping bags, and pretend that you enjoy the outdoors. And all the better if you actually do. And we did, at least for a little while, as my children and I pulled into our campsite at Coon Fork Campground 30 miles east of Eau Claire. Standing at the edge of our site, we peered out at the glistening 62-acre lake, while overhead the birds welcomed us with song. My 8-year-old son shimmied beneath my left arm. My 6-year-old daughter took refuge beneath my right. Together, we all inhaled a gallon-sized breath of cool Wisconsin air. It was the best of times, indeed. Right up until the storm struck a few hours later, sending us speeding back to the comforts of our home. Warm beds never felt so good. Returning to our site the following morning, I was relieved to find that the weather gods had taken pity on us. Our tent had not become a houseboat as I'd feared, merely a waterbed. No matter, it was nothing 10 absorbent towels couldn't fix. Our return to Coon Fork the morning following the storm came with an added challenge. Our 9-month-old baby, who was destined to enjoy her first day of camping while my wife went off to work. Perhaps enjoy is too strong a word. Maybe endure is more accurate. Which she did, suffering little more than a forehead scrape after a topple from the cooler while Daddy extinguished an unplanned cook stove fire that had scorched our lunch. Best of times, indeed. When my wife and the puppy pulled into our campsite at day's end, she witnessed a scene pulled not from the pages of Dickens, but William Golding's Lord of the Flies. We were scraped, sunburned, hungry, tired, and trapped in a soggy tent. "How's it going?" she asked. The baby wailed. Sometime after midnight, I woke to the sound of my wife searching frantically in the dark for a diaper. We searched by cell phone glow as the baby's discomfort grew. "I think one's in the van," my wife whispered. Untangling myself from my sleeping bag, I high-stepped over the snoozing puppy, tripped on the lip of the tent, had a run-in with some overly confident raccoons, and at last retrieved the diaper as directed. Then I reversed course, past those raccoons, over the tent lip, and atop the snoozing puppy. Proudly, I handed the diaper to my wife. "And the wipes?" she asked. I sighed. After that second trip to the van, I lingered on the edge of that star-filled lake stretched before me, listening to the nighttime serenade from insects I probably couldn't name. It wasn't the sound, but the stillness that stays with me, a stillness that seemed to neutralize the many mishaps that had compounded throughout the day. I took in one last gallon-sized breath before returning to the tent, where, upon entering, I saw my entire world snoozing safely together, a pile of legs, arms, and stuffed animals all woven together. I reached for my sleeping bag, only to find that the puppy had since commandeered it as his own. Well played, dog. Well played. Finding a spot on the tent's damp floor, I reached for a towel, closed my eyes, and took my place in the pile. It was the best of times, indeed.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now to the work of eliminating barriers to accessing mental health services for the Latinx community, destigmatizing therapy sessions. A mental health clinic in Madison launched a program called Salud Mental, providing culturally relevant training and bilingual clinicians. Join in on expanding mental health resources, gaps in care, your experiences with language barriers, cultural influences. 800-642-1234. Nancy Gomez is a psychotherapist and Salud Mental Program Director at Anisus Therapy. Nancy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Well, if you could just set us up with what obstacles do Latinos face in seeking mental health services?
Oh, that's a broad question, but it's so many. It really is just kind of recognizing where mental health is all across, right? Right now with the pandemic and even before the pandemic, people's need for mental health services were so large. So when the pandemic hit, that just kind of intensified. However, the big barriers are, of course, language. There is the financial pieces, the insurance piece, and also transportation. And the last piece is there's not a lot of clinicians that are bilingual. So the big piece overall is just the accessibility of resources for that population.
How is your program Salud Mental looking at those obstacles and addressing them?
Yeah, so right now what we do is we provide the resources in the sense that we provide information. We provide information on what is mental health and what isn't mental health, destigmatizing mental health all across the board. Any chance we get, if we're to sit down in schools talking from, you know, elementary school all the way to parents and parent meetings, talking about what mental health is and what isn't, destigmatizing, and that mental health is a very normal thing. And even within the cultural piece of it, providing that understanding or that information in a cultural lens so that, again, it further destigmatizes people's idea of, right, what is mental health. Even the name Salud Mental in itself means mental health in Spanish, because we wanted something to be very transparent. And that's one of the big pieces. And the other one is just providing the support for clinicians to feel comfortable in practicing in Spanish. Since there isn't a lot, right now there's only one in W Madison where they have a program that provides understanding of what is these certain words, right? Diagnosis in Spanish, providing that support for clinicians, not only within Anisus, but overall Dane County area.
I understand your clinic, Anisus, currently has 6 bilingual therapists on staff. And I'm just wondering, what supports do they need? What does it look like when a person who speaks Spanish is seeking counseling from someone and is seeking that bilingual environment?
Yeah, so right now, from what the information that was given from my clients, as well as other agencies, when an individual seeks mental health services in Spanish, oftentimes they're met with a translator. And sometimes these translators are not fully able to provide that cultural component. So then they're often left with confusion of, I'm not sure if you're able to really understand me. And then they stay away from mental health resources, and knowing how difficult it is already to seek that mental health piece, because we have been conditioned not to speak about things that might be, you know, difficult, but rather just kind of endure it. So then within our staff, it's, you know, providing the parallel support for clinicians themselves so that they can provide that care to their clients and to that to the community overall.
Let's bring on a call now. Kim is joining us from Madison. Kim, you want to look at this bilingual piece. Go ahead.
Hello. I just want to ask, how can the county increase the retention of bilingual mental health providers?
Thank you, Kim. Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good question, since what right now we're seeing is we have clinicians that come here that are practicing, that get certified, and then they leave the Wisconsin area or they leave Dane County as a whole for other opportunities. And the big piece here is just providing the resources and the support for bilingual clinicians to stay. So that means retaining them with supports. That means retaining them with incentives, similar to other programs with like social work, where they're able to get that under like the support when it comes to financial, you know, payment of their school, or even like increasing their payment, just because it is clinicians that are able to speak two languages are able to work in two different whole communities, as well as do a large amount of work.
I would imagine too that it would be nice to seek a clinician who is of your background, who perhaps looks like you or has had similar experiences to you in their life. What impact does that have?
Huge. It's quite interesting where I bring this up to some of the clinicians that are starting off here at Anisa's and in other areas, where just by simply existing in that space and you have that shared identity without having to explain anything, they might have something similar, like they look like you, or you know that they speak your language and have a similar upbringing. It is just not like, it's huge in the sense that a lot of my clients who are, you know, starting mental health work, they didn't know that there was a space for them here. And that's what was kind of often said, even with the adults or the parents that I work with, they didn't know that they were even welcomed in the spaces around mental health.
Psychotherapist Nancy Gomez with us on the cultural influences that could prevent the Latinx and Hispanic community from seeking mental health care services. Join in with what you've encountered. Access to care, culturally relevant therapy, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nancy Gomez here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. I'm glad you could be here. We're in conversation with psychotherapist Nancy Gomez. Her mental health clinic recently launched a program. It's called Salud Mental. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, only 34% of Latino adults with mental illness get treatment, compared to the nationwide average of 45%. We're looking at why, what can be done. Join in, 800-642-1234. Nancy Gomez, a licensed marriage and family therapist, manager of the Salud Mental program, with us for about 10 more minutes. Nancy, can you give us your vision on what success looks like? I mean, you've launched Salud Mental. What would success look like for this program as it unfolds?
Yeah, I think for overall, what we're constantly working is providing more trainings, not only for clinicians, but overall the community as all, that these are trainings that other clinicians from other agencies are able to come and understand how to provide that cultural appropriate lens when of seeing, you know, clients of this population, and as well as providing, you know, groups for parents, you know, teens. We have so many visions on what we're wanting to do. It's just more of capacity. And that's kind of the big picture of having a consistent, stable sustainable ongoing programming for just the overall Dane County area.
You mentioned groups, and I'm just wondering, what about support groups as kind of a vehicle to help break down stigmas that you see in this area?
Yes. So what we're doing, and ESIS is running different groups throughout, you know, the summer. And right now we're having actually a group for African-American mothers. We are wanting to do that same thing, but in Spanish, right? So that means parenting groups in Spanish, substance use treatment groups in Spanish, as well as right now we're going to be launching a teens art group in Spanish. Mm. So especially for those looking through for summer activities, having a space where they know that they're able to perhaps have all their identities be supported.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm just wondering how the group setting can kind of change perceptions, perhaps, or make people more comfortable in opening up.
Yes. So within the Latino population, we are very much a community inspired population. Mm-hmm. So us wanting to provide that group setting, it is to further build community and having mental health be further destigmatized and have it be something that's really celebrated and talked about.
What about self-doubt and shame that you mistakenly believe that your condition is a sign of personal weakness or that you should be able to control it without help? How do you work past that in your community?
That is huge, actually. I was just in a community event a couple of weeks ago, and that was met with a lot of resistance on, I should be fine, everything should be okay. If I just really, really want this to work, then I should be okay. And it's just meeting clients where they're at and validating that they have these beliefs. This has helped them to get to a certain point, and it's no longer serving them. And it's really joining them where they're at and being there and providing them the resources for when they're ready, and not so much rushing the process, because oftentimes you're met with that resistance even further, and more of validating that experience and understanding where that's coming from. If it's a cultural piece, if it's just a wanting to be okay so badly, right? The internal strength and seeing it as that. It's a strength that's allowed them to get to where they're at.
Hmm. I'm not sure that we've talked about this, but you also have two free mental health drop-in clinics in the Madison area. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yes. So we have, like you said, two Mount Zion, which is with the partnership with the church. And what it is you are able to come, no need for scheduling, no need for insurance. It's absolutely completely free. And it's just for you to come if there's a crisis or if you're needing to talk to someone, and you can just very much drop in. The reason for these drop-in services is because there is such a long wait list and all across different agencies that we know that there is some people that don't have the ability to wait or don't have that insurance pay or even financial means to talk to anybody. So that's through Mount Zion, and very similar is replicated in the Lighthouse Church School. There, same thing, no need for insurance, no need for scheduling, and that is on Fridays throughout the summer as well, even when it's the school, and you are able to come talk to a clinician, even if it's just to access resources. So like if you're needing help with housing or if you're needing help with, you know, food, you're able to come in, drop in, and talk to someone to give you that support that you're needing.
It sounds like you're able to be a community partner here, that you're able to do this through partnerships with a church or with a nonprofit.
Yes, they are. So they came to us because of the large need that they saw in their community. Mm-hmm. So then that's when we partnered with them of, we understand the need is there, let us help as well.
We're talking about access to mental health care, destigmatizing mental health services in the Latinx community with Nancy Gomez. She's program director of a new initiative with Anesis Therapy in Madison called the Salud Mental Program. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nancy, you mentioned these training sessions, and I'm just wondering if you could kind of take us inside of a training and what you're trying to help clinicians with.
Yes. So for, let's say, just the Dane County area, the programs that provide our training for therapists or clinicians are all in English. That means we learn how to diagnose someone. We learn the symptoms all in English. The trainings are then able to just translate and be able to provide that cultural piece of it. Some words that are in English or even diagnosis don't have a translation that our clients are able to understand. So it's kind of being comfortable in the Spanish language to be able to have these conversations so that the clients are then able to further join in the session and have an understanding of what is really happening for them.
Before we have to go, I just want to ask you, as a marriage and family counselor and in seeing patients in the pandemic, are there new challenges you're seeing in the issues you address in therapy sessions in the pandemic?
Yes. Self-esteem. So a pandemic just intensified everything that was been going on before. So that means self-esteem, self-harm, depression, anxiety, all of these symptoms have been so intensified, and the pandemic just removed everyone's coping abilities that we had before, that we were comfortable with, that we were able to sustain. So then now that the pandemic has slowly been, you know, leaving, I guess you can say, but it's still here, people are trying to transition back, and it's not the same. So that's kind of the big piece.
There is so much need out there. How do you take care of yourself?
I have a really big support system, my family, my friends, and my coworkers. And I am very a big person of self-care and boundaries. So that's my go-to, always having to take care of myself and check in on myself and my other coworkers.
And before we let you go here, what about the virtual piece? So much has gone virtual with telehealth in the pandemic. We've also seen these online portals for direct-to-consumer mental health services popping up. What do you make of them?
That's a need. That's a necessity. So Anissa's, right when the pandemic hit, we didn't really have time to really not be providing support for our clients. We transitioned to mental health right away. So that means we cut within a couple of days so that our clients are not having a large gap in their services. We are a big mental health provider as well when it comes to telehealth. And we always, again, try to meet the client where they're at. If that's in person, if it's virtual, we are flexible.
But is something missed in translation when it is virtual?
That connection piece, it just takes longer to join with the client. And we're very transparent sometimes for some for that connection. Mm-hmm. However, we as a clinicians, our priority is to build and give that space for clients. And if clients sometimes are wanting to meet us in person for our first session, or even if it's to meet them in a community setting, mm-hmm. we are very open to that.
Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
Nancy Gomez is a psychotherapist in Madison, the program director of Anissa's Therapies, Salud Mental. Just ahead, we spend the hour on personal finance and finding answers to your money challenges. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.